You're listening to Slow Theology, Simple Faith for Chaotic Times, with AJ Swoboda and EJ Gupta. In the next couple episodes, AJ and I are going to be talking about some of our recent research and work, books that were published around the same time, actually. First up, we'll be talking about Dr. AJ Swoboda's book, The Gift of Thorns, Jesus, the Flesh, and the War for Our Wants. But I also want to mention, just real quick here at the beginning, thank you for those who are dedicated listeners of Slow Theology. AJ and I do this ministry because we care about those who are listening and the hurts and challenges they're facing, the encouragement that's sometimes needed in our walk with faith, in faith with Jesus. And we just like talking to each other. So if people want to listen in, that's all the merrier and all the better. But give us a rating on your app. Spread the word, because we really want this to be a resource and encouragement for those out there who are dealing with things like deconstruction, doubt, disappointment, and disenchantment with God and the church. Also, new initiative. I'm kind of a follower. So when I saw that AJ had a Substack, he started a new Substack early 2024. It's called The Low-Level Theologian, which I think is ironic, because he's quite a high-level, a brilliant theologian. But I understand what he's doing. He's trying to be with the people. He's incarnational in that way. But I would subscribe. I am a subscriber, by the way, to Low-Level Theologian. I probably get the paid one. I don't know. I just click, and if I have to pay, I will. But great stuff, really thoughtful, devotional, personal material there. And inspired by AJ, I started my own Substack. I started it like 4 years ago. I didn't do anything with it, but I restarted it about 2 weeks ago. It's called Engaging Scripture, all about the Bible and biblical studies. Subscribe, check in. You'll get resources and hopefully some encouragement along the way. But today, we're going to talk about The Gift of Thorns, which is AJ's book with Zondervan Press, forward by James Brian Smith. Before we get right into this book, AJ, I'm really interested in your career, because you're not a traditional academic. You started your career, your kind of post-college days, actually in college probably too, in, you know, boots on the ground ministry. You did college ministry. You were a pastor of a church in Portland, where I live, for a number of years. And then you shifted, you got a PhD and you shifted into the academy, teaching at Bushnell. It's not a normal, you know, I went the more normal route where you get your PhD and you go straight into teaching. That means that your writings, your heart, your ministry is geared in a different direction than a lot of traditional academics. Tell me a little bit about who you are as a writer, who you are as a kind of public theologian, what drives you, and what are some of the common denominators in your books? This isn't, for those listening, this isn't his first book, okay? This isn't even like his fourth book. This is like his eighth or ninth or whatever it is. So tell us a little about who you are as an author, what drives you, what's your passion, and what connects your writings together.
Yeah. NJ, in a lot of ways, I've actually had to come to terms with wrapping my mind around being okay with the fact that I did not take the traditional route. In fact, there is, and I've had to wrestle this out quite a bit. There's been a almost subterranean level of shame that had I gotten more clarity into the if I had gone deeper in the academic world earlier on in my mind, literally, that I would be somebody, which is the most ridiculous.
You'd be a high level,
or high level theologian like that. And man, that I know myself, and I've learned about myself, the work of pastoral care, was like such a sacred and important time in my life. And it was, in many respects, I feel like I wish I could and do want to go back to that. I mean, I'm doing more pastoring now than I could have ever imagined as an academic, but those years of being in the lab of the world, being with real people, really has shaped me. And in the history of the church, I mean, my goodness gracious, nearly all of the theologians that have impacted the life of the church over its 2,000-year history were pastors and shepherds. They were people that were caring for people in the ground. It's actually a relatively new phenomenon to have theologians who are separate from the church. And I think it's actually harming the church that theology is done apart from it. The way I like to describe my calling is this. We all have people who are heart-to-heart people with us. They are people who understand our heart, and they're people who we can express our heart to. These are good friends. These are people who like get us. These are people that when we're with them, we connect on a deep, intimate, emotional level. That's a friend, a heart-to-heart friend.
Right.
We also have head-to-head relationships. These are people who stimulate our minds. And they're people who, like, when we listen to them, or we talk to them, or we read them, they minister to our intellect. What I really feel called to do, NJ, is a weird blend. I actually feel I'm not called to be heart to heart. I'm not mind to mind. Like, I do not feel called to make my mark as an academic among academics. That is right. Not what interests me. I'm not a heart to heart person. I'm not a head to head person. I feel like my calling is to be a head to a heart person.
Yeah.
Which means that I feel called to use the life of the mind as a way to reach the human heart. And here's how I know, like, I'm doing my job is when I can do a ridiculously thoughtful and nuanced lecture on the ontology of the Trinity. And before we're all done, we are all weeping at the mercy of Christ.
And not weeping that it was boring. Or,
no, that it was, like, no, that it actually turns out that the Trinity speaks to the real human condition.
I love that. It's the pastoral nature in you, but you're a naturally curious, intelligent, inquisitive person. I'm very similar. I don't do it as well as you do, but, you know, it's funny when people read my books and they listen to my lectures, no one ever says, that guy is really smart.
Really?
No one ever says that. That's never been something.
Or they're just terrified to tell you that. Oh,
no, but they'll say other things that kind of hit at what my calling is, which I think is similar. But people really value that and value that blend of bringing this intellectual information, academic information into a place where it can really soak in and transform the church, transform a community. What I've noticed is people can handle more academic information than we think they can, as long as it's presented compellingly and in a very engaging way.
Yes, yes.
I've noticed when I tend to preach more intellectual sermons in terms of academic information. I'm preaching this Sunday. I'm going to be talking about Hesiod's Theogony. I'm going to be talking about Roman politics. But I might quote some Weird Al Yankovic in there somewhere, and I'm going to talk about DreamWorks Prince of Egypt. So you got to mix it up a bit. But let's, before we get into Gift of Thorns, because I think you're hitting the nail on the head in terms of your calling with this book. Before this book, so this is 2024, you've written, you know, quite a number of other books. Before this book, is there a book that's really kind of special to your heart? That it's like, you know, I have books where I'm kind of especially proud of the book. Like, okay, this is kind of a legacy maker book for me in terms of if I could only choose one book to make an impact on others from my library, it would be such and such. What's that? Is there one for you? Because I have some of my favorites of the Swoboda collection, but is there one that's kind of special to your heart?
Hands down. I mean, the two books that I would say that represent something really what I believe to be a gift to the world. I mean, nobody looks at their children and says, this is my favorite child. I mean, you're not supposed to do that because you love all your children.
Right.
And some of them are weirder than others, but you love them all, but they're all unique in their own way. I love all my children, my literary offspring. I love them all. But I, it's hard for me not to look at Subversive Sabbath and After Doubt not be particularly proud of these two. I think After Doubt probably to me represents the nearest thing to my, other than Gift of Thorns, I think it represents the nearest to what God created me to do, because it is deeply academic. I mean, if you read the footnotes, I mean, I think just like 20 pages of footnotes. I mean, I did my work. It's deeply academic, but at the end of the day, I am speaking to real humans on the ground who need theological resources to navigate the reality of a complex world. And that book to me is like, it is head to heart in the most, that represents something very close to my calling.
You know, it's interesting. I would say my more recent books are more of kind of the books I would choose as well. Does that have something to do with maturing as a person? That you're in a better place to be able to say, gosh, I know myself better. I know my calling better. Or is it maybe coincidence?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think the very first time that I went into my counselor's office, this was years ago. His name was Raymond. First time I went into my counselor's office, you know how you have to fill out those intake forms that where they basically say like, hey, why are you
what's screwed your up?
Well, you know, what's wrong with you? And I had to fill out the form and I walk into his office. He'd never met me. He didn't know who I was and I didn't know who he was. He'd come by recommendation by a mutual friend. So I'm sitting in his office and he's going through my intake form and he notes the part about my occupation. And he says, it looks like you're a pastor and a teacher and you're a writer. And I said, I love to write. I'm like 34 years old at the time. And he goes, well, how many books have you written? And at the time I was just finishing up my fifth book.
Yeah.
And he looks at me without even thinking. I mean, he didn't bat an eye. This guy knew his stuff. He goes, you're 34. You've written 5 books. I said, yes. And he goes, let's talk about your relationship with your father.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
And what he was saying, he was absolutely right. Yeah. Is that this compulsive drivenness to need to produce so much at many stages in my writing journey represents deep wounds that have not been healed.
And processing. I mean, if I'm going to put a positive spin on it, your writings, they're not just like tactical manuals. You're talking about life.
Yes. I'm not minimizing my children. I love my children and all children have a beautiful place in our life.
Yeah.
But to your question about as we mature, do we write differently? And I think a shift for me has been now, I do not just want to write a book because I can write it. I want to write a book because I can't sleep if it's not written.
Right.
Like it is in my bones, kind of Jeremiah in my bones. Like,
yes.
And this book, Gift of Thorns, was a bone book. It had to be written. And if it didn't, I would be violating something of who I am.
Yeah. I discovered a kind of truism a number of years ago that stuck with me and I pass it on as much as I can to authors. Don't write for reviewers, write for your audience.
Yes.
And I think of like the website Rotten Tomatoes, and there's like the critics score and then there's the audience score. And like, okay, what's so important about the critics? I'm an audience person. I'm a pretty lowbrow movie watcher. And I had to learn early on in my career, my first several books, I would work so hard so that I would please every type of audience, including critics. And then I failed to actually give voice and speak to and focus on the actual intended audience. But let's get into Gift of Thorns. Let me set this book up a little bit, because you and I have talked about how, even though you published your book now and I have a book coming out in a couple of years, we were actually researching on the same subject and didn't know it, which is essentially love and desire.
Yeah.
I just turned in a manuscript to Erdmann's on a book on Paul's theology of love. And you came out with this wonderful gem of a book. But I just like we said, we're processing our own lives through these books. You more transparently than me, because mine's an academic book and yours is kind of crossover. But I grew up in an environment where, kind of a more traditional Indian environment, where boys in particular are not supposed to show emotion. And we're not supposed to, the bravest posture is boys don't cry. The best choices are made in cool reason. And so basically emotion is the enemy. Anger is the enemy. Crying is the enemy. I remember my parents, when I'd have a bad day, say, oh, don't cry, don't cry. I don't say that to my children because I've learned how important emotions are. But I got to tell you, for, I don't know, 20, 25, maybe 30 years of my life, I was taught by every culture, every sector of my existence around me to bury feelings.
Wow. Hmm.
Because reason is supreme.
Yeah.
And reason and emotion are mortal enemies and only one of them can win. And so you stuff feelings. This is like a therapy session. Anyway, so when I saw this and I thought about my own journey and even our journey together with our spiritual director, Morris, part of my book comes out of this journey of rediscovering the gospel in our feelings. We academicize and intellectualize the gospel so much because we talk about believing with our minds.
Yeah.
We don't realize the Greek word for cardia, a heart, and for nous, mind, are often interchangeable in the Bible. But this book is really about, okay, correct me if I'm wrong, it's really about redeeming desire.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Can you tell us where this book come from? Because I know that a busy person like you has a million things they can be doing and writing and speaking, and to sit down and write a book, I don't think most people understand what kind of commitment and time it takes to sit and research and write a book, especially one as personal as this. This is one of your most personal books, maybe your most personal. I haven't read all your books. Sorry, listeners, confession, I haven't read all of AJ's books. But where did this book come from? Why is it so important that you had to get this out of you?
Yeah, I mean, I really resonate actually with what you just said about being raised in an environment where being raised in a space or an environment or in a place. I don't think I was raised to be like this, but be in a place where the way to deal with one's desire or emotions is the default template is to stuff it, to stuff it. In fact, I've jokingly said, you know, one of the things that I do as an adult that I know is deeply harmful to my son, and I am learning to address it. I'm learning to repent of it. But one of the most harmful things that I do is when I'm not doing well and he can tell, I will say I'm fine. And I jokingly said, because what I'm basically telling him to do is to not pay attention to what he sees. I'm gaslighting. And I've jokingly said
I've done that.
Oh, we all do it, but it's so dangerous because I'm basically saying, believe my lies.
Yeah,
because they know it. They're not fools.
You're trying to comfort them, but it's not actually helping them.
Exactly. I mean, really, what I'm doing is comforting through a lie, which is never true comfort.
Yeah.
I've jokingly said that if the Swobodas had a family crest, it would be some picture, and then above it would just be our family crest motto would be, I'm fine. Like that would be like the crest. Yeah,
the coping mechanism.
Yeah. So early on, I mean, Nijay, the problem for me and really the soil of this book is that from a very young age there were some very painful, unchosen sexual experiences that I had as a child that in many respects set, and therapists, counselors will talk about this, but the idea of how my template was set. So a template is like your earliest experiences tend to frame so many more of your later experiences. Yeah. And anybody, you know, if anybody who's listening remembers the first time they saw pornography for the first time. And I remember like it was yesterday. The ironic thing is I don't remember my first grade teacher's name, but I remember that imagery like it was yesterday. It sets a template for us. And as a result of that, of those templates that were set very early on, my desire as an adult, my desires from all of my years on, there has been a really toxic and dangerous set of desires that have arisen out of that template. And I've, as much work as I have done in the realm of therapy and prayer and spiritual formation and being pastored and having friends that are truthful, a few years ago, I came to receive those wrestlings in my desire as one of the ways that God is deeply forming me. And that actually it has been through those thorns in my side that I have met the grace of God most. I have come to believe that those thorns have not represented places where God has failed me. They have represented places where God is now meeting me. And so this book, I mean, it's called The Gift of Thorns. And there's a story behind that that I don't want to rob from the reader's joy from the beginning to the end of the gift of thorns throughout the story of the Bible. But Paul's language of his thorn is that he has these thorns, this thorn in his side. We don't know what it is, but he names it in 2 Corinthians. He says that this thorn is actually doing something in me. He says it is keeping me from being conceited. He talks about his thorn as though it is a gift in his life. Yeah. And that is the point of the book, is I know there is a whole world of people who are trying to follow Jesus who wake up every day of their life bearing a backpack of desires they have no idea what to do with. Yeah. And I am tired of tired is the wrong word. I need to be able to know that there has been somebody who has written about that experience and done it in a way that does not say that the desires are all good, chase them all, but also doesn't say stuff them.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote it.
One of the things you point out in the book, which, you know, again, I've been on a similar journey in terms of research, is some of the terminology that the New Testament uses for desire, like epithumia.
Yeah, yeah.
Is used complex. In negative ways, yeah, like, yeah. You know, crucifying the desires of the flesh. The word flesh appears in your subtitle. So clearly some desires are bad, like in the Garden of Eden and wanting something you shouldn't want, that sort of thing. Yeah. But then, as you also point out in your book, Paul longs to be with the Philippians. Yeah. He uses the same word for desire. So you can't just look at the word and desire and say that's a virtue or that's a vice. How is that a difficult thing for Christians to navigate, but also unlocks some really beautiful things because desire itself is not the enemy?
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head. The Genesis account, the creation account, unquestionably casts desire as a good.
Yeah.
The humans were created with good desires for friendship, for relationship, for community, for God, for good food, for to rule and reign in God's good creation. These are good desires. And of course, following the saga of Genesis 3, the humans leave the Garden of Eden with their black eyes. I mean, they are leaving wounded. They do not stop having desires. Yeah. And that's actually how I define the flesh, is the flesh is God's good desire separated from the presence of God.
Hmm.
So desire, in essence, becomes contorted, twisted, toxic, but it's still good. God, desire is good. We were made as desiring creatures. In fact, when you look at the Genesis 2 account, there's a really interesting little signpost here. All of the creations, the animals, are all made in pairs simultaneously. So they are made at the same moment. The male and the female are made together. The one species of land creatures that is made that is not created at the same simultaneous moment is the humans.
Yeah.
God creates the man first, and then he has to wait for the woman. He longs for her. The humans are the only creatures created in the Garden of Eden with unfulfilled desires.
Hmm.
And it is, and it's like God wanted Adam to not only know him, God wanted Adam to know him as his provider.
Yeah.
Desire is good. Desire separated from the presence of God is the flesh. You know, here's one of my biggest envies in life. I struggle with this all the time, is when I go for an exercise, maybe in a previous episode I said this, when I go for an exercise, this is my greatest envy. When I run by my neighbor's house and their garage is open, and I see how organized their garage is. It kills me.
I love it.
It absolutely kills me. Dude, like, it keeps me up at night.
Yeah.
And you know, here's the deal. I have had to learn to embrace the fact that at 43 years old, I would rather be a good father than have an organized garage. Right. And the irony would be, how horrible it would be if my garage was organized, but my son was neglected. Part of being a healthy Christian is not just recognizing that desires can be good and evil. Part of being a follower of Jesus is recognizing we need ordered desires.
Yes. And I actually, you asked me to endorse your book, which I happily did. And I actually talk about Augustine there because I said, this is your confessions.
Yes.
Because we get this, the language of this from Augustine and his idea of ordered desires. I'll give a confession right here. This is live on the air. I'm on a diet right now.
Good for you.
I'm on my Get Healthy
Spring. I thought something was up. I mean, yeah, you're just I'm in your shining. Glory. You look good.
Yeah, my clothes are baggy. No, not yet. But but I'll tell you what, like, hunger is a tricky thing, and this has to do with desire. The solution is not denying desire or suppressing desire.
Yes.
It's prioritizing your wants. I love that you use the word wants in your subtitle, The War for Our Wants. So, you know, I often talk about this as the famous marshmallow test. So you're probably familiar with this. The marshmallow test is, you know, you get a kid in a room and, you know, psychology test, and you say, you know, I'll give you one marshmallow now in front of you. But if you sit there and not eat it, I'll come back and give you two marshmallows.
Right.
And so you have to kind of face this war in your head, if you're a little kid who wants marshmallows, between immediate gratification now, or long-term, something more
delayed gratification. Right.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously this isn't about marshmallows. When I'm thinking about, you know, oh, my stomach's growling, I really want to eat, you know, some pretzels or some, I made my daughter toast with honey because she wasn't feeling well this morning. I'm thinking, I can't eat this, but I'm smelling it. I really want it. I have to think, like, what do I want more though? Like, I want to be healthy. I want to not have diabetes. So I love that idea that this is a war for our wants and the goal. One of my pet peeves is when people say, I'm mad at so-and-so. I love them, but I don't like them. And it says, like, love is this stoic, cold-hearted, passive thing. And when we do that with love, then it's easy to project that onto God. And then God doesn't have feelings, and God doesn't love us in the way that we love apple pie or the way we love our favorite movies or our favorite people. God just tolerates us.
Yes.
You know, I used to have this view that salvation was this mechanism from a robotic God where he's like, dang it, you people screwed everything up and now I have to fix it. But when I read the New Testament, I read a God that always operates out of love that God actually feels. How crazy is that? It took me, 45 years to figure out that the gospel comes out of a God who has actual feelings.
Yes. 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 Yep. Yeah. The delayed gratification idea. Can I just for a moment settle in on that? Because the temptation in our moment is that we don't need to wait for anything. So there's this huge, as we're recording right now, obviously AI is taking over the world, planning its takeover.
It may have made this episode. We don't know.
This is, by the way, it is truly AJ and NJ. We would just like to be clear. It is us. It is
maybe.
In all the stuff that's going on with AI, there's a huge, there's one, it's really interesting. There's one community that's freaking out like big time. And I was reading about this just a few weeks ago. The pornography industry is freaking out because best guess is in about 10 years, 80% of all pornography will be AI generated. So it's putting a whole industry out of work in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
When we think about the place of something like pornography, and you ask the question, like, why is pornography a virtue? Why is it an evil? What is it about it that's so bad? When I do my lecture on the Song of Songs, there are a couple of people who ask the question, isn't Song of Songs just pornography? You know, it's the depiction of these two people making love to one another. The problem with Song of Songs is there's no problem with Song of Songs. Song of Songs is not pornography because bodies, that's not what pornography is. What is the problem with pornography? The problem with pornography, one of the main problems with pornography, and there's many of them, but one of them is that it cultivates a culture of people that do not have to wait.
Right.
It gives immediate satisfaction and does not call anybody to have to put off the desire for the sake of true, good, and godly satisfaction. We say that Jesus is slow to return. He's going to come fast. Lord, the eclipse just happened. And everybody thought he was going to come this week. We all want Jesus to come back. I want Jesus to come back. But his return is long awaited. Hmm. Well, what happens when you have to wait a really long time for somebody? What's the virtue in having to wait to have sex before you're married? What's the virtue in not getting that thing that you want right away? Is that it makes the enjoyment of the thing so much better when you've had to wait. Yeah. Jesus is taking his time because the satisfaction of the Lamb's Supper, the supper of the Lamb, is going to be so unbelievable because we have waited and waited and waited, and God has provided, just like Adam waited for the woman, the church now waits for Jesus. Martin Luther had preached a sermon once on Jesus in the boat with the disciples, and he asked the question, why does Jesus fall asleep in the boat? And he has this line in his sermon where he says that Jesus falls asleep in the boat to arouse the disciples' desire to want to call out to him. That in feeling as though, where is God, that would arouse their desire for Jesus.
Yeah.
By the way, thank you for your kind endorsement, and thank you for your always incredible support towards my work. But I wrote this book in conclusion. I wrote this book because Christians, man, there's countless books on how to live differently, how to Sabbath, how to read your Bible, but there's so few books. There's a few, but so few books that deal with our wants and our desires. And that, it just needs to be a core feature of our discipleship in the 21st century.
Yeah. What I love about your work, AJ, is, you know, it's insightful and that's important and that's kind of the payoff, but it's honest. It's raw. It's it says the things that we often don't talk about in the church. Mm. I've heard sermons on desire and on, you know, sex and things, but to talk about it in such a personally open and vulnerable way. And you often present yourself as someone still on a journey, a journey of being, becoming. You've researched and grown enough to be able to write the book, but it's a never-ending journey of formation, I guess is the way to put it. So the book, again, is The Gift of Thorns, Jesus, the Flesh, and the War for Our Wants. Came out in February. It's a spectacular resource, something to sit down with, maybe with a group of people, and have open conversations about what we're all going through. What I love about these kinds of books is in God, there's no fear. There's no fear to talk about the things that make us uncomfortable.
Right.
If you're around safe people, if you know that God is with you, the Spirit is with you, dare to have those conversations. I waited too long. I waited until I was in my 40s to have those conversations, to open things up. And I got to tell you, there's no going back.
Yeah, no.
I'm so glad that I found someone I could talk to in my family, but also outside of my family. So I encourage listeners, find someone you can talk to about what's going on inside of you. Read this book, but also find a safe person, safe community to be able to explore these topics because they're so important. Thank you, AJ, for writing this. Bless the hands that click on the keyboard and the mind that put this book together and keep writing. Thanks so much for listening. Pick up his book when you can.